Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 26th of January. This hour of the program, we talk about the Supreme Court's 5-4 decision last week, giving American corporations the right to unlimited political spending. There is much concern about this. There was talk from the president, if you heard his radio address last Saturday, that the decision easing limits on the campaign spending by corporations and labor unions was something that he said he couldn't think of anything more devastating to the public interest. Somebody wrote a piece saying that there are two things that are important in politics. This was Mark Hanna saying this. The first is money, and I can't remember what the second one is. The second one in this particular discussion may be whether or not too much money may increase corruption and decrease public trust in government as a result of that. We have two guests with us this hour, and I'm sure we'll have many phone calls during All Things Political. We had a ton of phone calls on the Supreme Court decision, so today, rest assured, we will talk about it the whole hour. Bob Edgar is president of Common Cause. He's with us the first half hour. The second half hour, Jeff Milo will join us, professor of economics and public affairs at the University of Missouri. Common Cause, of course, a nonpartisan, nonprofit advocacy organization founded in 1970 as a vehicle for citizens to make their voices heard in the political process and to hold their elected leaders accountable to the public interest. Edgar said last week the Roberts Court made a bad situation worse. The decision allows Wall Street to tap its vast corporate profits to drown out the voice of the public in our democracy. Our phone number, we'd like to hear your opinions on this, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And the email address, talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. Bob Edgar, president of Common Cause. Hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's great to be with you, Kathleen.
Did you see this one coming?
Well, we were geared up for a bad decision. I call this decision the Super Bowl of bad decisions. It was kind of foretold when the court earlier decided that corporations are persons, and they voted 5-4 in the past that under the freedom of speech clause of the Constitution, corporations should be covered. This decision came down with a strong statement on the part of five of the Supreme Court justices, but an even stronger statement, I think, on the part of the four who dissented. I think they realized that our founding fathers and mothers were not sitting around a table thinking that money is speech or that corporations are persons. And Common Cause and other good government groups are really working to try to figure out how do you modify this terrible decision and figure out some strategies, and one of which is public financing. But let me say one thing that I think is important to share with your listeners. I don't think there's anybody in your audience there in Wisconsin and beyond who thinks that in the mortgage crisis and housing crisis, investment crisis, banking crisis, the whole year of healthcare debate, and what's happened over the past few years on the defense debate and energy debate, that corporations have not had a voice. I think you can see that large lobbying interests have already shaped much of the debate. And I don't think anyone believes that somehow these poor, unfortunate labor unions or corporations need any additional help. And this decision simply puts that aside, allows corporations and unions to dip into their treasuries rather than political action committees, not really giving very much power to the Federal Elections Commission to both monitor the money that's being used in the political agenda, but also transparency of knowing who, in fact, is putting the money in. I could imagine a congressional district in Wisconsin where a large rogue corporation could walk into a congressman's office and say, look, we're not spending any money against you yet, but we didn't like the way you voted on this issue or that issue, and so we're going to write a big check, and it doesn't matter how many hours you spend raising money, we're going to flood the district with negative commercials against you if you don't change your opinion. That fear factor is also something we need to worry about.
Mm-hmm. Bob, you mentioned public financing. That's been on the table in this country for years and years and years. We may move very incrementally toward reforming the system, and now we're back to where we were. But we never get there. Why don't we ever get there?
Well, I think there's more of an opportunity to get there now than ever because the grassroots and the general public are realizing that money is just corroding the whole system. We were fortunate a year and a half ago on November 4th, 2008, that in Connecticut, after they put their previous governor in jail, the legislature passed public financing. 71% of the candidates running for the state legislature in Connecticut used Common Cause's public financing system. And 81% of them got elected, including a 24-year-old college student. We have public financing in Maine, Connecticut, and Arizona. We have it in cities like Albuquerque, Portland, and partially in New York City. So it is spreading. And the good news at the national level, we're in a campaign called Fair Elections Now. And that bill was introduced by Senator Dick Durbin on the Senate side. And on the House side, we have more than twice the number of co-sponsors for public financing this year than ever in the history of the House of Representatives. I served in the House from 1975 to 1987. I was one of the Watergate babies. And I can tell you back then, it was a challenge to raise the money that's needed. In the last 25 years, money in politics has just been exponentially growing, and most candidates spend 40%, 50%, 60% of their time raising money. They are really frustrated. I think there's candidate fatigue in raising money. I think there's also donor fatigue in how much money is in there. And with the issues that I've mentioned, it was special interest that changed the laws that caused many of the banking and housing issues that we faced over the last 2 years. People are getting it, that we've got to separate those special interest lobbyists and their money from the political process. Lobbyists aren't bad in and of themselves. It's when they have the toxic cocktail of money and lobbying power that they have been able to buy and sell elected officials. So I think if the public gets out there, we're hoping that this spring people will be angry enough and we'll be able to get Nancy Pelosi and the leadership of the House with the support of Democrats and Republicans to pass Fair Elections Now in the House and then address the issue in the Senate. With the filibuster in the Senate, it's much more difficult there, but I think public outrage needs to build and put pressure on elected officials to really look at Fair Elections Now. And your listeners can go to our website, which is just www.commoncause.org, and it will detail this kind of innovative public financing system.
Mm-hmm. Those who were in favor of the ruling say that there is no evidence that independent corporate or union expenditures lead to political corruption, and therefore there is no basis for government to restrict this activity.
I think there was an audible moan when people read that portion of the decision. We only have to point to the congressman in San Diego who happened to be a Republican who took $4 million from corporations to support the defense industry in San Diego, or the congressman Democrat in New Orleans who had $90,000 of cold hard cash in his freezer to realize that money influences the political decisions. But then just in the subtle ways, take a look at the healthcare debate. The conversation around the public option or single payer was already corroded before it ever got to the House and Senate floor last year by how much money was put into the system. Common Cause did an analysis, which is also up on our website, called Legislating Under the Influence. We discovered that from 2000 to 2008, the medical industry put $3 billion into hiring lobbyists and an additional $350 million into the campaign coffers of Democrats and Republicans who serve just on the committees of jurisdiction. So when you hear Max Baucus or Senator Grassley and the Finance Committee talk about health care, you need to look beyond their conversation at how much money the medical industry had put in to make sure that their comments were, in fact, targeted around their special interest. On the House side, the same thing. Democrats and Republicans received a whole ton of money. And I can retire as president of Common Cause the day after every public official serves the public interest and not the special interest.
Hmm. Are there any restrictions on this money now? If you put an ad out for some candidate in your huge corporation, does there have to be a disclaimer saying this ad is brought to you by whatever the corporation is?
That's one of the things that I know the president and the House and Senate are going to look at to see if they can curve some fences and restrictions around this decision. There is a proposal afoot to suggest that the head of the corporation has to appear on the commercial so that there's a connection. They can't give the money directly to the candidates, but they can put ads on radio and television or in the newspaper. They can hire people to work for and against particular candidates. In those respects, given the Supreme Court's decision, there are very limited restrictions. I would point out one other thing. It's going to also wreak havoc state by state. I know that certain forces in every state will now go back and look at all of the controls on election processes in their states to see whether or not they can open up the floodgates for much more money flooding into the system, either by labor unions or by corporations, and whether or not this decision will strike down existing controls that are there. Another option that people are looking at, and I think maybe some of your listeners might be interested in, are shareholder resolutions confronting corporations and trying to look at ways in which they can insist that corporations and labor unions voluntarily agree not to dip into their corporate treasuries for political purposes without a two-thirds vote of the shareholders or the members. I think there will be some controls like that suggested legislatively, state by state, region by region.
Mm-hmm. Let me just ask you briefly, the New York Times had an interesting piece on this James Bopp last week, and it was he advised the winning plaintiff, the conservative group Citizens United, and this had to do with Hillary the movie. He says here, and he seems to be getting his way with the Supreme Court, that there's a suit now on behalf of the National Republican Committee. It's pending in the United States Court of Appeals, seeking to overturn some of the limits on direct corporate contributions to political parties. He filed this a few years ago, then many legal scholars considering the suit almost pointless because of Supreme Court precedents. But now it's seen in a much more favorable light. If you can't ban corporate spending on ads, how is it that you're allowed to ban corporate contributions to candidates?
Well, I think that is the opening of Pandora's box. That's the can of worms that we face moving forward. And it gives more energy to looking at voluntary public financing systems being put in place and candidates being stung by the general public if they associate themselves too much with those decisions that allow for corporate and labor unions to control. I mean, I can envision 5-10 years from now that, you know, my fantasy is you look down on the State of the Union address and you look out and you have a whole section of Exxon Corporation.
Oh my gosh.
And you have another section where Boeing Vertol or Lockheed have defense contractors in one corner, and, you know, we get the government that we stumble into. There was a amusing thing on the web a few years ago that said that members of Congress ought to be like NASCAR drivers and have to wear uniforms that have patches on them showing where they're taking their money from so that the average citizen could see how much money they're taking from the banking interest or the housing interest or the insurance companies with big corporate patches on their sleeves.
What? Give me that figure again. $3 billion hiring lobbyists for the health care debate? $3 billion?
Yeah, it's in a study entitled Legislating Under the Influence. And from the year 2000 to 2008, it was $3 billion from all of the insurance companies and the medical industries and the hospital associations, et cetera, hiring lobbyists to shape the debate on health care. And in on top of that, $350 million, and we detail the congressmen and senators and how much each of them took from these special interests, $350 million just to the House and Senate members who serve on the committees of jurisdiction. So for the public to have their interests seen, and there are a number of public coalitions. There's something called HCAN that labor unions have put together, and some of the progressive groups. There's a group called Families USA. I serve on that board, which is a group trying to get universal health care passed. There's another group that I serve with, the former Republican governor of Iowa, Bob Ray, called the National Coalition on Health Care. Those groups are not spending really very much on lobbyists per se, but they are trying to represent the public interest here and just being overwhelmed by all the corporate money that's flooding into the system.
Bob Edgar, president and CEO of Common Cause, is our guest. He spent 12 years in Congress and was the general secretary of the National Council of the Churches of Christ in the USA for 7 years before he became president of Common Cause. He was elected to the U.S. House in 1974, representing the 7th Congressional District of Pennsylvania, part of what you heard him say, the class that was nicknamed the Watergate Babies. We're going to welcome phone calls. Our number 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, Adam Cohen will be joining us. His book, Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle and the 100 Days That Created Modern America, has just been released in paperback. It's a great book, so we'll have a good discussion the second hour. We go to phone calls now for Bob. Kevin from Platteville, hello.
Good morning, Kathleen. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, normally I'm pretty conservative all across the board, but this really has me bothered. Corporations, if you think about the whole basis of the country was to become free of the power of corporations, and here we are reverting. Corporations are primarily driven for profit and for elitism. You figure, you know, their top CEOs are paid so much to be paid like maybe hundreds of times as much of people working for them at minimum wage. You know, this is an injustice, an elitist injustice. This is the mind of corporations, and they will use that power to buy the political system to reinforce that power. And anyway, it just really bothers me, and I think most people are going to be too busy to think about. Also, there was a thing about there's a difference between corporations that are profit-driven organizations and grassroots efforts. The grassroots corporations, these are people who are voluntary members, and they know where their money is going. They want their money going there. But corporations, these are people who hire maybe thousands of people. They have to go to work to pay their bills. They have no choice but to put their money into that corporation. And so, anyway, and the corporation doesn't care about that.
Bob.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think our country, its democracy, is best served when persons are considered human beings and corporations are corporations. And as you indicate, there are corporations that are larger than many nations. Many of our corporations are international in scope. And the idea that the Supreme Court voted 5-4 that corporations are persons and that they should be considered under the rules of the Constitution as persons doesn't make any sense to me. What makes sense to me is to have rules and regulations that monitor and oversee corporate governance, the ethical good government part of corporations, and another set of rules for individuals and human beings that are different. And we ought to really take a look at this decision because it has all kinds of implications. I heard someone yesterday say they wanted to do an op-ed piece, which was kind of tongue-in-cheek, saying, You know, they may be persons, but they don't have hearts. You know, what is the blood that flows through corporations? And you could have all kinds of amusing thoughts about thinking of corporations as individuals. Does that mean if they're persons, they should pay a third of their profits in taxes, like individuals have to do? Are they covered under other individual person rules and regulations? I think the court went too far. And it's interesting that the conservatives on the court and conservatives in general have complained about activism in the court. This is the most activism that I've seen in a judicial setting in years and years and years, and that's why I called it the Super Bowl of bad decisions.
I think that angle is an interesting one. If you are a person, you need to pay one-third of your profits in taxes. That's an interesting one, isn't it?
Well, I think, you know, just you could sit down and figure out all the rules and regulations. The other thought that we had, just, you know, an individual can only give $2,400 to a political campaign. So why shouldn't corporations only be able to give $2,400 to a political campaign rather than unchecked, unlimited money that they can flood into the system?
Well, do those kinds of ideas make their way to the court again then?
Well, we're going to figure out some strategies to do it. We've coupled with a group called Public Citizen, another group called Public Campaign, the Brennan Center, Demos, a whole host of good government groups, and we're going to try to really look at this issue and deep frame a response working with Republicans and Democrats who are frustrated and angry about the court's decision. Again, remember, the decision was 5-4 with a few changes in the court. This kind of decision can be modified, but I think we've got a conservative court that brought us a number of decisions over the last 10, 12 years that have been startling, but this is the most startling, in my opinion.
Diana from Blair, hi.
Hi. We've heard a lot of discussion about how it affects the small businessmen, but what worries me is the fact that many corporations are multinational, in some cases totally outright owned by foreign entities. This now increases their influence in our electoral process. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I think that's exactly right. They'll have much more influence. And again, back to my original point, who among us thinks that corporations and labor unions don't already have undue influence on the system? Do they need more power? Do they need more ability to frighten elected officials or candidates running for office? Do we want a nation that's solely run in the interest of a specific energy corporation or healthcare corporation? Don't we want a nation that's run by people who get themselves elected from whatever party, and once elected, rather than serving the party, they serve the public interest and not the special interest? This court decision will simply exacerbate and flood more money into the system by special interest.
One more call for you, and then we'll switch perspectives. Gene from Oshkosh, hi.
Good morning, Kathleen, and good morning, Mr. Colin Claus. We're members of both of your organizations. I am confused. Historically, corporations were created for two purposes. One is that humans are terminal. And a corporation, by the way, the Mayflower Compact and many other versions like this were attempts to create corporation, what has become known as corporations. So one thing, if someone had an idea and created a business and died, that business was no more. Perhaps you could sell assets and things like that. But that business was no more. The other thing is, if I have some capital, some houses or buildings or whatever, and my business goes bankrupt, the corporation serves to protect my personal assets from corporate assets, if you will. So a corporation was never designed to do what the Supreme Court has suggested that it is natural for it to do. In fact, I don't know what a corporation is other than a fiction, a delusion, in order to accomplish some very narrow end.
This is Bob Edgar. I'm both a preacher and a politician, so I say amen to your comments, and you're my candidate for the next opening on the Supreme Court.
Bob Edgar, thank you very much. We'll be in touch because I'm sure we haven't heard the last of this issue. Thank you.
Very good. Take care. Good to be with you.
Yeah, and you, and good to have you here. Bob Edgar, President and CEO of Common Cause. Common Cause, a nonpartisan, nonprofit advocacy organization founded in 1970 as a vehicle for citizens to make their voices heard in the political process and hold their elected leaders accountable to the public interest. We have a different view now of the Supreme Court decision. Professor Jeff Milo is going to be joining us, professor of economics and public affairs, adjunct professor of political science at the University of Missouri. Our phone number remaining to the same, and I promise you we will get to some of your emails during the course of this half hour as well. That address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org for you to join our conversation. There's been a lot of discussion about the Supreme Court 5-4 decision and what direction those who are opposed to that decision will go from now, go to now. And also we're looking now at why there is support in this country for the decision as well. Professor Jeff Milo, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah. So this did not surprise you, this particular decision. And tell me what it was based on.
Well, individuals have a recognized right to engage in independent expenditures, so not coordinated with any campaign, as do groups that are not corporations or unions. And so the issue was that earlier decisions had created this anomaly where independence of a candidate had been assumed to be already a sufficient safeguard against corruption or the appearance of corruption. So if that's the case, why doesn't it also apply to corporations and unions?
Mm-hmm.
And so there was this inconsistency in the law, and given this case, it looked like the way that inconsistency would be resolved would be to lift the ban on independent political expenditures by corporations and unions.
Do you think that there is a direct connection between lots of money being poured into campaigns and possible political corruption?
Well, that all hinges on how you define corruption. So if what you mean, I think in the common parlance, what people mean by corruption is influence by people I don't like, then yes. If what we mean is literally political corruption, criminal activity, quid pro quos, and personal enrichment by people in power, then it may go on, but there's no real systematic scientific evidence that any kind of reforms that we've experimented with have any impact on true public corruption.
What kind of influence will the Supreme Court decision have on elections, coming up elections? How will things change?
Well, corporations and unions not too long ago, if we go back before McCain-Feingold, were allowed to engage in unlimited issue advocacy, which many people felt came very close to the border of express advocacy, advocating for or against candidates. And so we all remember, you know, the AFL-CIO ads that would have scary music and grainy pictures and say, you know, George Bush is a bad person, or you know, similar on the other side. And they never said vote against George Bush. They never said vote for Al Gore, but you got the message.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was not crossing the line into actual campaign advertising, because it didn't include an express and treatment to people to vote for or against someone. The McCain-Feingold reform, early 2000s, said, let's broaden the definition of what is campaign speech to capture that issue advocacy. And so if we go back before 2002, we're in a world that's going to be similar to where we are now. Except that now corporations and unions will be engaging in independent campaign expenditures. They can say vote for or against, but they've also got to disclose mm-hmm. that activity. So it'll be much like things were a few years ago, I guess, would be the I think the best prediction.
Let's talk a little bit, because we hear a lot in this discussion about whether or not corporations are they're being thought of as human beings, were part of this decision. And there are restrictions, as our other guest from Common Cause was saying, on contributions by human beings to political campaigns. If you're saying that corporations are also human beings, then why shouldn't there be limits on their contributions?
Oh, and there absolutely are. And this is part of the problem, is the more wild-eyed reformers are knowingly misrepresenting what this decision was. So it has been illegal for corporations and unions to give directly to federal candidates. For corporations, it's about 100 years that law has been in place. For unions, it's over 50 years. And that still exists. This decision did not affect that at all. Corporations and unions cannot, they are prohibited entirely, not just limited, prohibited entirely from giving to candidates for office. What this decision had to do with is speech that is independent of a candidate. So someone wants to spend their money to give their own opinion or an organization's opinion about a race. And that's different from giving direct money directly to a campaign, which raises more concerns in most people's minds about some sort of quid pro quo going on. And so the court has long recognized the difference between these independent expenditures, not requiring as many safeguards because they are independent. They're not coordinated with candidates. They're not allowed to talk to candidates about what they're doing. And so it would be harder to arrange any quid pro quo versus direct contributions, which raise more suspicions. So that's one thing that people should be very clear on, is it's still the case that corporations and unions can't give. Now, what's interesting is at the state level, the states have a variety of laws, and many states allow corporations and unions to make direct contributions to candidates. So when I say there's no evidence that these prohibitions influence political corruption, it's from looking at that variation across states, and do we see differences in policy outcomes? Do we see differences in voter turnout and the closeness of elections in political corruption? And you know, to be overly broad, these campaign finance reforms have very modest to no impact on any outcomes of interest.
Regarding what you were just saying, the Times had a piece on yesterday, I believe, with a professor at Columbia Law School asking this question, Nathaniel Persily: if you cannot ban corporate spending on ads, how is it that you're allowed to ban corporate contributions to candidates? That is the next shoe to drop.
Well, that's not so obvious, because, like I said, the court has long recognized that these are different things, and that that direct contributions may raise more of a suspicion of quid pro quos. Now, whether you want an outright ban versus a limit, many states allow direct contributions to candidates by corporations and unions, but they put a limit on it, $1,000, $5,000, and the like, as a means to try to prevent an exchange of money for favors. So getting back, though, with this idea that, you know, are corporations individuals, that's one way to look at the decision. Another is that individuals don't give up their rights of association and free speech just because they're in a union or they're in a corporation, and that since these are very effective vehicles for people to participate in the political process, that this prohibition is then suspect, because it really is a hindrance on an individual's ability to participate. You know, that we do have free association as well as free speech. So we're allowed to pool our resources and get together with other people and try to make the best case for our arguments.
Yeah, but a lot of us aren't members of unions, or we're not members of corporations either. You're saying that they should be speaking for us.
No, not speaking for everyone, but individuals are allowed to do that. I mean, that's the, you know, if we live in a free society and we recognize these rights of association and speech and that we only infringe upon them for very good reasons that are well established, you know, that's the problem, is there's a lack of evidence that these prohibitions do anything good. And so, you know, I completely understand that most people don't like big unions or big business and don't want them to have influence. But that's why we have a Constitution and a Bill of Rights. It's so that the majority can't interfere with those fundamental rights, even when they think it's for the common good.
What do you think about getting as much money out of this whole system as possible and just doing public financing of all of our campaigns?
Well, that is, you know, that's been offered as a panacea by many people over several decades. And, you know, I think a lot of the theoretical arguments for public finance are interesting. Often reformers will kind of ignore the unintended consequences that might occur. So, for example, you know, taxpayers really aren't fond of thinking that they're subsidizing people's political speech that they don't agree with. And, you know, you get into the question of, well, how exactly are candidates going to qualify? And, you know, can some nut job qualify and now they're publicly funded and I have to pay for their speech? Apart from those kinds of concerns, there's another issue, which is, getting your message out and having a robust, highly competitive campaign takes resources. And by trying to put, you know, a damper on that, there's evidence out there that where there's more restrictive campaign finance rules, people are less knowledgeable about politics. They're less interested in politics. They're less likely to vote. All this speech and debate, it has a good function. It's educative, and it gets people riled up, and it makes campaigns salient, and it gets people involved. So there's another unintended consequence there. But lastly, if your goal is, again, to limit corruption or the appearance of corruption, and that's what the courts have said is the only rationale that would allow infringement on these rights, there's absolutely no evidence that public funding accomplishes those goals. In fact, the only study out there is one that I've done with David Primo up at the University of Rochester, suggests just the opposite, that you actually get some perverse effects and that people are less trusting of their state government in states that have adopted public financing. I suspect that's because, again, these are offered as a panacea, and then people discover that politics is still politics and they still don't like it. And then on top of it, you've got these additional restrictions and people are subsidizing politicians. And so it turns people off a little bit. So public financing, you know, I don't think that the public debate has really seriously engaged the costs and benefits of it or the evidence behind it, that there's really little evidence that it accomplishes anything of any good. So, you know, people have this romantic approach to politics often. If only we adopt this reform, whether it's term limits or voter ID or early voting or public financing, then everything will be different and everything will be wonderful. And politics is always going to be a kind of hurly-burly and distasteful sort of enterprise. And we hope that over the long term, you know, we get reasonable outcomes out of it.
And yet the problem, at the risk of being too simplistic about this, is huge amounts of money. Our previous guest was talking about $300 billion
well,
being
why
spent.
Is that a
Let
problem?
Me just,
it's What's a, the problem about it?
The problem is that there was $300 billion spent to hire lobbyists in terms of this health care debate that we've had. The health care industry has a certain way they want to go with health reform, certain things that they were very much opposed to.
Yeah. Why is that a problem?
Because
people whose livelihood depends upon these regulations and who know a lot about the industry, who know a lot about the issue,
why
is it a problem for them to speak in a democracy where we enshrine the right
because
to association and the right to speak?
Because
How
they
is
have
this
three,
a problem
they,
that people are getting involved?
Excuse me.
It's wonderful. We should celebrate it.
Because they have $300 billion and we don't.
It's because, but saying they and we in that way is what's overly simplistic. There is a multiplicity of interests, and the healthcare industry is not a monolithic interest. There's a variety of interests, and some want some kinds of reforms and some another, and they're making arguments. They're not buying policy. They're making arguments and trying to make their voice heard, and they're trying to talk to the people. They're running commercials, and they're sending out flyers. And without that, people would be less concerned about what's going on, and that would be a bad thing.
But don't you think their concern is making money?
And again, what's wrong with making money?
Nothing's wrong.
Why is that bad?
Nothing's wrong with making money, but if it's at the expense of our health, there might be a problem.
Well, I think the health industry actually improves our health.
Yeah, I understand.
They're
that.
Kind of in the business. That's how they make money, is they make us happier and healthier. So they do have that interest at heart. That's how they make money. You know, you could make a good case that healthcare reform would improve health and that it was in the public interest. You could also make a good case that it would do the opposite. And so there are differences of opinion. And in a democracy, people voice those opinions. I think your objection is more related to that there should be somehow an equality of participation rather than an equal opportunity for sides to get riled up, to donate resources. You know, those corporations and lobbyists, they still only have a certain number of votes. And so that's what they're trying to do, is to try to influence people's opinions. And that's what democracy is all about. And when we see that activity, we should celebrate it and be thankful that we live in a free country where people are allowed to do this. It's a good thing that we're arguing and we're bringing forward studies and having this debate. This is the wonderful thing about democracy. It's not something to be distrustful of or to be negative about. This is democracy. And to claim that you have to turn it off in order to save democracy is just entirely backwards. It's completely inconceivable to me how that ever got such popularity.
Let's go to Frank from Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen. Your guest makes some pertinent comments, and I would like to, and I'm very happy that he is concerned about democratic institutions and equal access and equal voices. And I'd like to ask him if he feels that there's any danger to creating a class of super citizens, which is what happens when you give a corporation the rights as an individual, the individual rights of citizens, and then you allow them, since they are a super citizen, the right to shout. So does he see any danger in a democracy to a class of super citizens, and that there might be a danger that the political class regards them as the only relevant constituents to whom they respond? That looks like the current situation. And I feel that the guest is a bit ingenuous, but I'd like to know if he thinks that super citizens might be determining what happens and that the larger mass of smaller, real people might be ignored. So thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, it's a good point and very well put, may I add, and I assure you that I'm genuine here. So and you know, we could argue on a theoretical level or about hypotheticals. You know, given what I've said, obviously I disagree with the premise of the caller, but I think the more enlightening thing to do is to go to the evidence and say, okay, there's a hypothesis about what happens when you allow corporations and unions unlimited independent expenditures. Let's go to the states. Let's exploit that variation in regulatory regimes that exists now and has existed for decades at the state level, and let's look at policy outcomes there. Is it the case that it looks like corporations and unions are running wild in the states that have more laissez-faire systems and not in other states? And I'm not saying that, you know, the science is complete on this by any means. There's only a few studies, really, we can look at, and every study has its flaws. But there's very little evidence that there's much different in states that have more restrictive regulatory regimes than in those that have more laissez-faire regimes. So to give an example, John Matsusaka at USC has looked at divergence in policy outcomes and opinion polls for a number of different issues. And do we see that you know, more popular policies are not adopted in states that allow more laissez-faire campaign finance regimes. You don't see that. You don't see any differences. As I said, do we see differences in trust in government? No, not really. Nothing big, nothing, you know, systematic that knocks us over the head. More studies could always be done, but I think that would be the way to, you know, I think the Enlightenment was a good thing, and we should use the scientific method, and we should do evaluation studies of reform policies, and more should be done. But right now, there just isn't evidence that backs up this hypothesis, and that's going to sound wild to some people, but for those of us who study the role of money in politics, there's decades of research that suggests money has a much more modest influence than many people think, and so it's really not that surprising in the end.
So let me go back to this healthcare thing, because we're very embroiled in this right now. It would be your contention that the bills, or the lack of bills that we're getting right now, are exactly what it is that the American public wants on this, that money has had no play whatsoever in fashioning the legislation that the Senate and House are letting go, it appears, right now?
Okay, you said two things there that need to be addressed. One is you said the public interest, and that's the first thing to address, because it's related then to this idea of influence. I never said money doesn't have any influence. It's that it's much more modest than many people think. And the issue, though, is that bad that there is influence? You know, if we didn't want our representatives to be influenced, we should put them in a concrete bunker underground and not allow any communication. And this gets to this idea of the public interest. You know, for decades, political scientists and political economists have tried to study what is the public interest. You know, how do we implement the general will? There's a couple of Nobel Prizes that have been given out to theorists that have basically said there is no such thing as the general will or the public interest, in a sense that there's no objective way to characterize this. You have your notion of what's the public interest, and I have mine. And in a diverse society, we will never come to an agreement about what the public interest is. That's why we have institutions as a way to try to come up with a collective choice. It's always a compromise. It's never going to reach some ideal of implementing the general will, because there is no general will to implement. Once you accept that there, you know, differences then in political institutions just mean different outcomes, not outcomes that are more or less distant to this perfect general will. So if once we take this idea of the public interest off the table, there's your interest, there's my interest, there's what you think is in the public interest, there's what I think is in the public interest, it's become silly to characterize the healthcare reform as in the public interest, because that's just saying, I like it, and I think it will do good for the country. And so what? Who cares? Your opinion's no better than mine or anybody else's. The institutions we have are the way that we kind of collect and make a decision. Changes in those institutions may give us different decisions. And yes, money may influence outcomes, although, again, there's little evidence that it has as much influence as many people think. But just because there's influence, just because there's a different outcome, doesn't make it illegitimate or corrupt or wrong. It may make it wrong in your opinion, but you can't say in some objective sense that it's wrong or not in the public interest. Democratic societies, the outcomes that come out of democratic societies have no claim to moral authority. They're just the outcomes that occur. And you know, legitimacy comes from we all know the rules and we follow the rules, and we all play by the rules. And so you have to kind of get comfortable with that and move away from this romantic notion of the general will being implemented. Once you do, it's hard to say money is going to pervert democratic outcomes, because democratic outcomes are already pretty crazy and perverse.
We need to pause for a moment. We'll return with a final email. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have tons of emails on this, and we will try and post them on our Facebook page, and we'll be on this issue again, because we just don't have enough time. We won't be able to get to all of you. Frank, thank you very much for the call, and let's go to Mark from Ashland, and we only have about 30 seconds. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. Very interesting show. I just have one comment for the gentleman. He continues to say there's absolutely no studies showing the correlation between corporate spending and political realities in this country. Well, you know, a lot of us, we don't really need studies. We walk down to the street and we look around. We look at our friends and neighbors. We look at our jobs disappearing. We look at our standard of living going down, and we notice something. All of us notice something. The thing that we all notice is the guys running the corporation are making vast amounts of money. The corporations are draining our country in the guise of being good citizens. This gentleman's very good at twisting up the words, but down on the street, they don't mean anything.
All right, we have 10 seconds, Professor Marlow.
You know, go back in time to when you thought times were good, and you would probably see the same things. I mean, that's why we really do want to have a scientific approach and try to use evaluation studies. And I'll defend the Enlightenment any day.
Thanks for being with us, Professor Jeff Marlow, Professor of Economics and Public Affairs and Adjunct Professor of Political Science at the University of Missouri, our guest. We'll be on this issue again. I'm sorry, everybody. Those comments we didn't get to, I promise you, we'll post them on our Facebook page. Go to Kathleen Dunn Show and mull them over. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and John Anderson for producing this show.